Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Before we begin, a reminder that we're going to bring you a daily podcast this week as we look forward to the end of the Premier League season. What follows is our normal Monday show with all of the bells and whistles you've come to expect. Tomorrow, on Tuesday, we'll have the first ever audio football club, Football Phone Out. You're familiar with the concept of a football phone in. This is the reverse of that. We'll be ringing our reporters around the country and Jamie Carragher to get their thoughts. On Wednesday, we'll have an interview with the presenter, comedian and Nottingham Forest obsessive, Matt Ford. On Thursday, we'll have a preview show looking ahead to the weekend with Sam Wallace here with me in the audio recording facility. And on Friday, another first for Audio Football Club, a women's football podcast looking forward to the World Cup this summer. As ever, we welcome your thoughts about what we've done this year, what you want more of next year, what you want less of next year, and what you think of this slew of shows building up to the end of the Premier League season. The email address is afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. Bring me my theme tune. Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. With the top four and relegation places sorted, the only thing left to be decided on the final day is the small matter of who will be Premier League champions. Liverpool overcome a surprisingly motivated Newcastle side, and today we look ahead to Manchester City versus Leicester. His farewell to Cardiff and Neil Warnock gave us one last bit of on-pitch nonsense, an almost admirable collapse for Spurs and Bournemouth, then more premature beach-dwelling rubbish from Arsenal and Manchester United. Plus the Turin derby, an incredible underdog story brewing in Spain, and the things in football which make us all feel 200 years old. Let's take you now into the audio recording facility where I'm joined, as ever, by JJ Bull. What's happening, JJ?
Hello, Tom. There's lots of football. Yes. Yes. The season's almost over. It's a bit sad because I think it's really great. I don't know why everyone keeps slagging it off, saying it's rubbish.
Who's saying that?
Some people.
Oh.
You know, they're saying like, oh, it's the worst title race ever. And I think it's great.
Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. No cynicism here. Sitting to JJ Ball's right, it is our friend Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
Good. I didn't know that it was going to finish next week. It's all too soon.
Really?
Yeah, I thought that, you know, we still have another like 14 weeks in like the other leagues.
Yeah, well, you know, England, we hate messing around. We get things done.
Yeah.
There's 2 weeks left in Scotland, that helps.
Is there? Yeah. Okay, I'll watch Aberdeen next week then.
Yeah, keep an eye on the major European leagues like Scotland. Joining us, completing our lineup, it is the boy wonder, Sam Dean. How are you, Sam?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me back. I feel like the season's still got a few weeks left. You've got the Europa League final in Baku, the big one.
Yep.
Then you've got the Nations League going on straight away.
That's true. There's plenty more football to go.
Oh, no, it's all about Baku. It's all about the Europa.
There's like an 8-week break between the end of the season and the Champions League final.
Yeah, that's what I think too.
It's weird.
Oh, there's also FA Cup. Yeah, that's one.
Yeah.
There's plenty more to go.
Plenty more to go and plenty to discuss. Let's start with the Premier League title race. I must admit, JJ, I've been not massively enthused by this title race, but finally it felt really, really exciting to me this weekend as Liverpool came through just about against Newcastle. Sam, you took me to task actually a few weeks ago when I said that this might be Liverpool's last chance for a while to win the league. I think you're probably right, actually. And so 1-0 to you. This game to me showed me that Liverpool have got so much character and determination. If it isn't to be for them this year, do we expect it's going to be much the same from them next year?
I think there's every reason to believe they should be as good, if not better, next year. I think if you look at their team now, you can see obvious areas of improvement within the players they've got. That's people like Joe Gomez, I think, will be, who hopefully won't get injured next year, will be better next year and be a more obvious partner for Van Dijk. Trent Alexander-Arnold will be better, more experienced next year. You've got players like Jordan Shaqiri, who will, I think, only improve having had a year there, and Naby Keita as well. So I think Liverpool aren't going to spend a huge amount of money this summer, but I think there's every reason to believe they will be just as good a force next year as they are this year. And I think you're right, this win, I think, showed that they're riding this wave. Klopp used the word destiny afterwards, and there's a sense of emotion and a sense of sort of like fate to it, I think, now. And the fact that they've had so many of these late winners, I mean, I counted them up, and I think you can say generously they've had 9 games this season where they've won in dramatic late circumstances, where they showed like sort of genuine character. One of those sort of title winning moments that you'd expect. Obviously, the issue is they're playing against City, but there's enough belief and momentum in this team now, I think, that even if they don't get it, I think Klopp's got enough confidence, I think, to build on this and go again next year, absolutely.
It does feel like even if it doesn't go for them, even if they somehow mess it up at home to Wolves next weekend, they've dispelled the notion that they're too fragile, that they're in some way too emotional. What did you make of the performance and the result on Saturday, Mina?
It's strange because when I watched Liverpool against Everton, at that time we were talking about whether or not they were emotionally fragile and whether or not they were feeling the pressure. And I thought that that game was an example of the fact that they were feeling the pressure and they weren't rising to the occasion as they should have. And I was quite harsh on them at that time because I was like, these are the kind of games in which you judge teams and you judge to see, you know, how far they can go and how far, you know, they've got to go. And actually, since then, they've been amazing. And they're doing this, they're winning these matches, every single match, always throwing everything in there. They look fit, they look mentally capable, they look physically capable. And this is despite the fact that they're also exerting themselves in the Champions League. So on that occasion, you have nothing but to congratulate them for all of these efforts, because it's not like, not even once have they looked like they're a team that just really cannot handle the pressure or are too tired or mentally exhausted to even try, which you have actually at times seen with City. So I think on that occasion, you have nothing but to applaud them for. Having said that, and all when we're talking about next season, I do think that if this is a team that does want to become the next big thing in the way that City has already become, I think there needs to be investments made on that in that midfield. I think that you saw that for all their beauty and their wonderful strategies in football and how attacking they can be, the level of, let's just say when you compare them to the likes of Barcelona, there's still something missing there. Sam looks like he wants to come in.
Just which player of the three would you want to improve on? Because you've got obviously Fabinho, who I don't think you're going to improve on as a holding midfielder. Keita, they've put a lot of expectation on to be the more creative going forward. And then you've got Henderson / Milner / Wijnaldum as the sort of energetic box-to-box shuttler.
I think they need somebody like a Coutinho. And I don't think Shaqiri is that. I think that... Listen, Keita's been only good now. He didn't exactly have the start of the season that made you sort of fall off your chair and think, my God, we found our next midfielder. You know, Henderson is good. They're all good. They're all a 7 or an 8 out of 10. But they're not Busquets or Modric or Xabi or they're not the type of quality that perhaps ensures that there's a constant supply to the forward line. And we saw that on so many occasions. For example, against Everton, you needed that guy who afforded them something going forward in terms of creativity. And I do think that while last season they coped without Coutinho because of their style of play, when they've started to become a little bit more composed and a little quieter on this occasion, this season, it looks like that Coutinho guy is missing.
Could that not be Oxlade-Chamberlain?
I mean, it could.
You don't sound convinced.
No, not really. Yeah, I mean, everything else just seems so perfect. When you have Virgil van Dijk, I think the two fullbacks are amazing, you know. I do think that you need an alternative in the forward line, somebody that can do something, an alternative to Firmino. You're nodding, Sam, to that one.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the main, more than midfield for me, I think that's the main area of shortcoming in the team. That when they've not got Firmino, I mean, Sturridge didn't look the part on Saturday night. I mean, I know he's had not had much game time, but he doesn't look the part. And Origi's never really been good enough. And you can't rely on Mane, Salah and Firmino being fit the whole time. And they've been quite lucky this year that Salah and Mane have generally avoided injuries.
So. That's one of the things. They've not had injuries really this season. They've been so lucky. Mm. You look at the Man City lost to Bruyne and they've had other players missing for a long time, but they're still on top of them.
And is it luck, though? Because something Andy Robertson said after the game was that he feels, and the team feel, that they're stronger and they're fitter than the teams they come up against. Do you think that's... Have you seen that from Liverpool? See that, really, from where we look at things?
I mean, they do look really fit. And they just run forever and ever. And they don't seem to be showing signs of tiredness even now, going right into the very end of the season, and they've got Barca, you know, and they were working hard against Newcastle. But... It's. I agree with Mina about the squad depth. If they buy anyone in the summer, bring anyone in or promote anyone from youth, it's got to be someone who is another level above the players they already have, because the players they have are already very good. But you don't really have these players like Luka Modric that float around, and when they do, they tend to go to Real Madrid or Barcelona. Like Frankie de Jong's off to Barcelona. He's one of the best options you'd get in the entire world, I'd say.
Van de Beek would be amazing.
Van de Beek's good, but he's probably great within that Ajax team and that Ajax system. I don't know if he's going to be great anywhere else he goes. If he goes to like Everton or Spurs, the kind of team I think he would go to, I don't think he'd end up looking that good. It's like some players look very good within certain clubs and systems because it suits them perfectly. But when you put them into another one, and like a counter-attacking team rather than one that holds the ball, then suddenly they have to play in a different way and it doesn't suit them. I think Liverpool need to have... they need to spend big on maybe one or two and just take it to another, try and take that next level. But I don't know what's going to happen this next week, but they'll still be remembered. This Liverpool team is one of the best Premier League teams we've got. You'll remember them in the same way, not as revered as like Holland 74, but in the same way you'll talk about this Liverpool team being a great one.
Newcastle 95, 96 are the team that I think springs to mind here. We're recording before Klopp speaks on Monday, where we're expecting to find out more about Salah. But on the injury to Salah, is it a bit strange that goalkeepers are allowed to charge out of goal in that way? When you see the height of Dubravka, where he catches Salah in his head, it's never really occurred to me as odd, because this is what we've always known, but it seems so dangerous when you see goalkeepers charge out like that, and it's inevitable that people, you know, sometimes suffer injuries, isn't it?
That like hilarious dad joke about keepers, you'd be mad to be a goalkeeper. I think there's a lot of truth to it. Whenever you play at any level, the one who's in goal has to be a bit mad, because if you're charging out, you know you can get absolutely clattered, because you're quite vulnerable having to stretch up to reach for a ball and try and punch it or something like that. And although his hips caught Salah, he has to kind of come out and make himself big while he's doing it, or he'll get hurt. And I mean, it's not as... They saw Alan McGregor for Rangers get sent off because he kicked someone in the back.
And then claimed it hurt his foot.
Yeah, that's kind of aggression you don't want and don't need, but he's mental. And you've got players like Dubravka yesterday, he just has to come out and do that. It's weird that they do get away with a lot of stuff in the box.
But. It's a strange fact of footballing life that an outfield player can't touch a goalkeeper when they try and challenge for a ball, but a goalkeeper can nearly kill an outfield player to get a ball and it's fine. You can just sort of throw your whole body in the way and punch the ball away.
But it is a dangerous role to play.
Oh yeah.
Like I was watching Kepa as well pull off a magnificent save in the game against Watford. And it just looked like his head was getting so close to the post. And I thought if that was me, I wouldn't make the save because I'm going to kill myself. So let's just forget that one. You know,
imagine the size of players running straight at you. Like I remember playing Sunday League and being put through on goal, running, seeing the keeper coming towards me, and like I know this is going to end terribly. But I jumped to try and get a knock on the ball or something, and the keeper was nowhere near it. Completely wiped me out. It hurt a lot, but I got a penalty out of it. So I mean, that guy's done the opposite way. He's seen me running towards him, and he's going, "I'm going to have to just go in hard here." And
so you're a little bit mad too.
Well, you've got to try.
That's why JJ can't remember his own birthday anymore, unfortunately. slightly surprising to me on Saturday to see Newcastle so up for the game. Do we think that was great management from Rafa, or do we think it was thanks to a day of hard drinking from their fans? I loved how Gary Neville described the crowd as bladdered on Saturday, which the atmosphere seemed great.
Was he not saying that managers in the last week of the season would just let their players get bladdered if they want? Because
he was saying the players were bladdered.
He was just saying that the last week of the season doesn't matter because there's nothing for them to play for, so they can just do whatever they want. But then he was impressed by how serious Newcastle were taking it. Rafa Benitez is a great manager. Like, that team's not particularly good, and they're performing. Like, they could easily finish top 10 next season or something like that if they'd improve in a couple of positions. But how is he getting them fired up for that?
I think tension and pressure is quite contagious in football. I think the fact that Liverpool came out and was so obviously wired and up for it, I think that naturally has a knock-on effect to the opposition, where when the guy you're up against is running at you hard and breathing down your neck, you naturally respond to that physically. I mean, the best example of that was Istanbul, when the 3-3, Palace had nothing to play for that day, but they went hell for leather to get back in that game and draw 3-3, and the crowd went mad for it because they knew it was significant, and that emotion of the game filters into the opposition even when that team has nothing to play for, I don't think.
I don't know. I wonder whether it's just like teams wanting to have their say on the title race and being like, you know, this is our moment to shine. This is the moment that everyone's going to look at us and, you know, on TV, and or we can just demonstrate what kind of team we are. And that just kind of motivates you anyway. It's a little bit like Chelsea having the game of their lives against Spurs when Leicester were trying to win. Although obviously that has also a different type of rivalry there. But it's interesting about how teams will go for things even when they've actually got nothing to win.
Yeah, so the conventional wisdom is that the teams that to worry about are the ones who've got something to play for and are fighting for their lives. But actually, that's more pressure on them, isn't it? And you could argue that the best thing is to not have any pressure at all. Anyway, speaking of pressure, let's move on to Manchester City, who play Leicester on Monday night. Very little pressure on Leicester, of course. They won the reverse fixture against City. How did they do it that time, JJ?
I don't know.
It was a long time ago. It was during City's really dodgy spell, wasn't it?
Claude Puel would often set them up to be really counter-attacking. And the kind of basics you do against City is you sit back and you try and hit them on the break. And you press high with a few players, but you have it a really deep line otherwise. Rodgers has Leicester playing in a different way. And they have more of the ball now. I think they have more possession of the ball, and they play far more passes now than they did under Puel. But although Leicester, I heard a lot of people saying that they think Leicester are going to take something today, they've got a feeling about it. I think they're going to get, I don't like predicting things, I'm always wrong, but I think they're going to get done. If you look when Rodgers came in, so they lost to Watford, who are a good team, so that's it's not bad. But they've only beaten Fulham, who everyone should beat, Burnley, Bournemouth in the middle of their terrible run, Huddersfield, worst team in the Premier League I've seen for quite a long time. They lost. They lost to Newcastle, who are a team. You know, that was a big game because Newcastle were trying to stay up. Then they drew with West Ham, not amazing. And they beat Arsenal, who were down to 10 minutes for 30 minutes.
Well, that's one way to look at it. I would say Arsenal were the only big club they've played, and they've beaten them 3-0, so that should give them loads of hope.
But Arsenal have fallen apart.
But Crystal Palace lost to like a bunch of people as well. They can barely get themselves, you know, motivated in certain matches, but they beat them.
Yeah, I think Leicester, so they seemed like really revved up after beating Arsenal, and they thought it was a really good result. But in context, it was 10 men, and Arsenal were just starting to fall apart. Like the pressure's really starting to tell on them or something. I don't know what's going on with Arsenal. I think Man City is the first proper, real, great team they've played since Rodgers has come in. And I think when City will go at them, and I don't know they'll be able to hold off. And I don't think it'll be a bogey team like they have been in the past tonight.
I don't know. I mean, I know what you mean, though, because when I look at it, I think it's definitely going to be a Man City win. But I do think that they'll threaten them. And I don't know why. I feel like Brendan Rodgers and the team will be a little more than Newcastle were, but really amped up to have their say in this match. And everyone's sort of being like, ooh, Leicester could get a point out of this. And they're going to be like, you know what, we can get a point out of this, you know? And I don't know whether that's going to motivate them or just to have their say. I do like the fact that Brendan Rodgers is starting to implement that high-pressing game. And if he does that effectively and you're using the pace of the likes of Vardy, which always tends to, you know, direct play tends to really undo City, there could be a chance. But I mean, we know that City are going to probably really give the best.
But that's it. If they're playing direct, that's not how Rodgers has them playing. So if he's setting them up to try and beat Man City tonight and he's doing it in the counter-attack, it's not really how Rodgers has ever had his teams play. But they will have less of the ball. And you look at where City will win the midfield, and Leicester's midfield is, they play like a 4-1-4-1, but they have two attacking midfielders as opposed to central ones. So they've got Youri Tielemans and James Maddison, who play through the middle. Now, you think you'd have to put another midfielder in beside Ndidi today, which would be maybe Choudhury. He's good defensive, kind of makes a lot of tackles. So then that would change the way they play, change the shape a little bit and make them just more like a 4-2-3-1, like everyone kind of plays, and City will just do them
But you can keep possession but still be direct, in the same that Barcelona was, you know, kept possession but had Andres Iniesta and Messi be more direct.
Sure, but that's just not how they'll play, because if they shift the ball quickly to the wide guys, then they've got maybe Damari Gray but might play on the right, and then you might have Maddison out on the left, but then he's not best out on the left. So to try and counter how good City are, you change what Leicester are good at in the first place. If he goes to that straight attacking team, it could be really interesting, because then it would be, I'd like to see how they have a go at them. But City are just a better team with better players, and I think they'll take them apart if they do that. So then that's why he'd go for a more defensive outlook, but then they'd still get done.
Yeah,
it will be revealed on Monday night. Sam, would you be a bit fed up if you're a Man City fan? I very much included this podcast in this, but everyone is focusing on Liverpool. If you looked at the papers on Saturday morning, loads of papers had a big Liverpool chunk in them. I think I'd feel a bit affronted if I was a Man City fan.
I think I'd accept that Liverpool are a better story, have been more entertaining, have been more identifiable for the average fan in terms of... I mean, we just talked earlier about...
I don't think you're putting yourself in a football fan mindset here, Sam. This is all far too reasonable.
I mentioned earlier the nine big moments for Liverpool this season across all competitions in terms of, you know, dramatic equalisers or late winners or that kind of stirring goal or big tackle. Nine for Liverpool, I reckon if you're being really generous, you could say three for City this season. They've just not had those moments of great sort of passion or any sort of excitement. And they've just been like a machine going on and on and on. And the fact that they obviously won it last year, they're really good. They've paid loads of money for their players. I mean, and JJ, I know you're a big fan. And because they are great and they play great football, but on a sort of narrative, emotional scale, they're just a different league to Liverpool right now. And it's, you know, this will be remembered as the year Liverpool don't win it. If it'll be known as the year Liverpool came so close and didn't make it. If they don't make it,
what if Man City win the treble? You think they will look back on this year as the year that a team didn't do something?
Yeah, I think this will be seen as the year. Oh, that was the year Liverpool went really close to it, much like 2013-14. When people think of 2013-14, they think, oh, Rodgers, Suarez, Sterling, Sturridge, what a team that was. They don't think, oh, yes, City were quite good that year with Yaya Toure scoring all those goals. They don't. The narrative is so centred on Liverpool because of the drama and the excitement of Liverpool and everything that surrounds that with history.
Yeah, it's history, isn't it? Because I think it's a lot to do with how many fans Liverpool have and how many supporters they have, because you have lots of, I'll just call them glory hunters, who live not from Liverpool, who supported them back in the 80s. You see them like there's heaps in London, as loads I know up in Aberdeen. But you don't get that with Man City. But that will surely come
in 20 years, though.
Well, you'd think it would, but it feels more, I don't know, there's something that feels more authentic with Liverpool because they've got the grand traditional history and they've...
It's a better story.
Well, maybe that's what it is.
This year it's a better story, but just like it was exciting when City were trying to get the title and Balotelli came on and it was Mancini, it was the first title, you know. It's always exciting when it's the first title in a really long time or first ever or whatever it is. And the fact is that when you support a team, you sort of want it to be a boring team because you want to be used to winning. You don't want it to be such an occasion every time that you come close or you won a challenge. It's always going to be more fun, much like City were, much like Leicester was or whatever it was when they were winning their titles. But now and it is exciting for Liverpool, but for City, if you just keep winning and you're playing really great football, it is going to just be a bit boring.
Spoken like a true Juve fan.
I know.
Nice to support a team you expect to win every week. Let's rattle through the rest of the Premier League now. Chelsea assured of their Champions League place with a win at home to Watford. Is this any sort of reprieve for Sarri, or has he just burnt too many bridges? Now, he didn't come out for the lap of appreciation, as we have to call it now, but he was just stood by the dugout watching the players walk around looking solemn.
I do take issue about this, like this whole culture thing surrounding Sarri, because I just feel a little bit like we've turned around and been like, oh, well done to, you know, Ole Solskjaer. Well done to, you know, Emery for doing a great job with Arsenal. Look at them flying in the Europa
League. I haven't said that for a while, Mina, I don't think.
But I do feel like this guy's gotten so much flack, you know, and right now he's overtaken the great Pochettino, who is, and even I agree, is true, a genius, you know. And despite all the terrible football, the presence of Jorginho, which really seems to irk so many, the fact that Kante hasn't been playing as a defensive midfielder, they got into the Champions League. They've guaranteed it without a great striker. They've guaranteed it despite the fact that they're relying on basically Eden Hazard to pull them through. But despite all of that, and I know that everyone loves to see fantastic play, he's gotten the points that he needs to get. And I don't know why he is such a hated figure. I don't know whether he just doesn't appeal to anyone. I've never particularly loved him in Italy because of different reasons. I don't like people who have philosophies, but, you know, we'll get back to that. But that's one of the reasons
Aristotle. Damn you.
Actually, I take issue with Plato more, but I'm more into pragmatism. But the fact is, sorry, stop laughing. But the fact is for me, like, you know, everyone quite, it's really bizarre because we know he has a philosophy of football. We know that Chelsea are built for a pragmatist because it's not a team that has great harmony in the way that they play their football or individuals that necessarily should coexist. And yet, despite all that, he's done a great job. And look how much even the likes of Guardiola suffered in his first season in City as he's tried to put together a philosophy and a style of play and teach all his players to do what they're supposed to do and motivate them at the same time. So Sadi just needs a little bit of time to implement this boring, whatever you want it, but it's his style of football. Either way, that's what they bought into and that's what they wanted from him when they brought him in. And he still managed to do something special despite not having a striker, despite Higuain coming midway through, despite all the problems with Kepa, despite all the booing from the crowd. And I think he's done a better job than what Emery has done. Well, unless they obviously win the, you know, Europa League. But then also Chelsea have managed it on two fronts. So I don't know. I don't get why everyone hates him so much.
Yeah, fair point. All sorts of nonsense going on beneath Chelsea in the Premier League table. Spurs, Arsenal, Man United, pretty dreadful weekends for all three of them. Just a remarkable joint implosion from teams all supposed to be chasing the Champions League. Let's start with Spurs. Two men sent off, including Sonny, in a defeat to Bournemouth. It's all looking very Spursy at this point, isn't it, JJ?
They've got the Champions League. I think they knew they were going to finish in Champions League spot, so they're okay. As we've said a couple of times in the last few weeks, that they just maybe run out of steam and their squad's too small.
The thing that made me laugh over the weekend was, Dyer was incredibly fortunate not to be sent off himself.
It could have been three times. Yeah.
You know, like if you've had a week where like your body clocks off and you just haven't slept well enough and you're just really like really narky.
I think that's
what's happened to Spurs. They're all just like so tired at this point because the squad's not big enough that they're furious.
Yeah, it was weird seeing Son react as well.
I loved it.
He's got a bump early on.
Proper wind-up job by Jefferson Lerma.
Oh, really? Yeah.
You've done well when you've got Son angry. Yeah. He's properly nailed him, I think. I think he stand on him or did he sort of punched him a bit in the back?
He ran straight into him, not a clothesline, but he just blocked him and I think knocked the wind out of him earlier and the referee didn't do anything about it.
He very much knew what he was doing. There was a few niggly bits and then Son just lost his rag. I thought that was a masterful wind-up job.
I think it's funny when teams fall apart like that, when their heads go and they start getting sent off and you think, just get everyone sent off, it's funny, go on.
Well, Spurs have got
history. I'd react the same way though if someone did that to me. I'm a bit of an angry person, so I really enjoyed Son.
But it was similar to the meltdown at Stamford Bridge a few years ago, the one that obviously won Leicester the league. Just the fact that it was a collective sort of heads gone. I love how they brought on Foyth to be like, okay, we just can't miss down here. 4 minutes later, Foyth plucked his stud on someone's knee, just outstanding.
What about Arsenal and Manchester United? You were at Arsenal on Saturday, Sam, Sunday even. Mm. What's going on with them?
I think they're just a bit shattered, to be honest. I think it seems like they've really run out of steam, and they knew from the moment they lost at home to Crystal Palace over Easter weekend, which was just an awful result. That's the one that really cost them. After that result, I think they knew it was top four wasn't going to happen, despite Chelsea and Spurs' best attempts to blow it up themselves. But they knew then it was always going to be an uphill battle. And I think since then they've sort of, whether it's subconsciously or consciously, have focused their minds on the Europa League. They know what they need to do, which is protect a 3-1 lead this week and then go to Baku and win. And that's going to be their last chance of fulfilling their be-all and end-all goal this season. I think they'll be fine in Valencia this week. I think they were quite good in the second half in terms of controlling the game on Thursday night in the first leg. They look a bit tired, but they've got Aubameyang and Lacazette up front who are still banging in the goals, and there's always going to be a threat in that sense. So all eyes on Baku and the Europa League, the big one.
To Baku, Cech and Ramsey saying goodbye on the pitch afterwards, but not many Arsenal fans there to say goodbye back to them.
No, I reckon about 20% of the stadium remained.
And
this is
why he's going to Juventus.
That and financial reasons. They also said goodbye to Danny Welbeck, which we knew he wasn't getting offered a new contract and therefore he was leaving, but there's been no sort of club communication or for example, Ramsey got a big, you know, here's all his achievements kind of video, and Cech's had loads of tweets and all this stuff about support, whereas Welbeck's just been sort of ignored pretty much. And, oh yeah, Welbeck's still here, and oh yeah, he's going, so bye. That was sort of it, which felt a bit cold. And then we asked Emery about it afterwards and he just said, so Danny's definitely going then, and all Emery would say was, yeah, I've spoken to the club and he's leaving.
Great, well, there you go.
A fitting tribute to Welbeck's commitment to his years at the Emirates, yeah.
Manchester United can only draw at Huddersfield. JJ, the attitude on Monday morning seems to be just burn it all down. friend of producer Joel Grove, Chris Sutton, said that they should start building around Pogba for next season. Where do you stand? How should they renew things?
And take it back what you said about Huddersfield. They got a point against United.
Yeah, it was a great assist from the goalkeeper as well. Punt over the top. Man United just looked horrible. And I agree with everyone who's been saying that the players switched off as soon as Solskjaer got the job. I think Solskjaer will do well there. They have to obviously get their signings very correct. If you look at the amount of money they spent in the last couple of years and how much they must have available now because they're so rich, to sell the ones you don't need, get rid of Sanchez, put him literally in a bin and just let it roll down a hill. And then you've got...
Oh my God.
What sort of bin?
A wheelie bin.
A large one, a comfortable one, or just any standard recycling tool one?
Any bin.
Wheelie bins don't roll very well because they're more angular.
Well...
I think with the weight inside.
You can go down a hill in the wheelie bin. I know.
Someone went to university in Scotland.
Anyway, you can... if you're in charge of there, they've got the money... If they went out and bought, this is like my dream signing for Man United, go and buy Ruben Neves and N'Golo Kante from Chelsea, or find players who have similar stats to them who are just there, and buy them, just those two, and straight away you improve that team incredibly, and you've got support in midfield to protect the defence. And defending's not done by individual players, it's done by a unit. They're going to have to buy probably a centre-back. Imagine they got De Ligt as well. It's possible that you could get him. That would just be three amazing signings. It would cost them probably about $80 million for each one. But they've got money. Sell Lukaku for 50, you know, shipping another one. They could probably do something like that.
I did an exercise earlier, because this is the kind of person I am, where I did a composite 11 of Wolves and Man U and Leicester and Man U. And admittedly, I was sort of...
I've done this too, Sam, weirdly.
Admittedly, I was maybe pushing it a little bit, but I've got 7 Wolves players in your 11 and 7 Leicester players in your 11. So I've only put 4, like man for man. At the moment, I mean, obviously they're all playing below themselves, but man for man, Man U aren't that much better than the teams finishing a few places below them. I mean, if I was them, I'd be genuinely concerned that next year Wolves and Leicester might be better than them.
Who's bad? Like, let's look at the teams that how many people would want these certain players. Like, there's Paul Pogba. I think Ander Herrera is a good player.
Yeah, he's going, isn't he?
Martial. No one rates him?
I think you can tell from the way he's not getting in the team and the amount of managers who just haven't been able to get anything out of him that he must not be a great influence right
now. Okay, I was like thrown to the wolves when I said that Lukaku was a little bit, you know, not great. Yeah. But I mean, everyone kept saying to me, he scores all these goals, you know. What about Rashford?
He's one of the best young players in Europe. I think he's amazing.
Okay, so then Juan Mata? You wouldn't take him if you were, I don't know, Leicester?
No.
Over James Maddison and Tielemans? No.
They're not done, but Luke they're just Shaw? Not good enough. I mean, Shaw's fine, but look, Ben Chilwell's a better player than Luke Shaw, like by far. And they've been run down, but they've been run really badly. The players there are not the kind of characters you want for a club that's going to win a title, get even anywhere near it. They need to buy world talents. You can't really buy more than 2 or 3 players in the transfer window and expect to have any continuity or keep developing. If you buy any more than that, you turn into what Spurs did when they sold Bale and bought a bunch of stuff that you don't need.
Liverpool with Suarez.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Look, I understand what you're saying about all this, and I do think that on many levels they didn't necessarily get the best players, but I do also think that there's an occasion in which they didn't actually buy the right players with the right attitude. Because I really feel like, for example, Martial to me is one of the most talented players I've ever seen play the game.
He's brilliant, yeah.
And unfortunately for him, for United, he doesn't have the right attitude, it seems. Alexis Sanchez feels like with that paycheck, he's arrived, perhaps not giving everything, and a little bit like a Mesut Ozil, I don't know. But I also have to say, despite all of this, and I'm not here to be like, you know, we saw that Mourinho suffered problems, Solskjaer's suffering the same problems. But there is also this type of, for me, coaching issues that I am taking, you know, you look at that team and you look at the fact that when the defenders have the ball and they're looking for the out ball, there is nobody, there's no movement, there's no one coming in to receive, there's few outlets for a pass. And I don't know, when you look at all the heat maps under Mourinho as well, it was like the three midfielders would all basically occupy the same spaces.
Yeah, I don't think it's coaching. I think it's just literally players not doing what they're supposed to be doing and they're not putting in the extra effort. You can see it just when, like, certain players at the bottom of the league, if they lose the ball, they sprint, they work really hard to get it back. When Tahith Chong came on against Huddersfield, he looked like a different kind of player because he was working really hard off the ball trying to win it back. and they just don't really have that desire. It's like they just know, ah, we're here, we're fine. I think a lot of players, when you sign for Man U, that's the peak of your career. You sign for Man U, not realizing that that's actually like the start of where you have to then work really hard to get really good.
But then you don't know, we shouldn't blame any coach for not being able to get something out of these guys to
sort
of
out of them,
move.
And then they stop playing. You just see it. It's a lack of effort, and then effort doesn't mean have to be like running and tackling, but just moving into positions to be in the right place. They're just so slow on the ball. They were walking with it against Huddersfield. They just walk in and they're drawing, and they have to try and get a win to get in the Champions League, and it's just not. You can't have that. You have to work harder than everyone else if you're going to win. Like Liverpool work so hard off the ball and on and with it, they're so quick. Man City, exactly the same.
Wolves, a lot of these teams work really hard to get where they are. But I don't know. I can't help but think it's just a really bad psychology within that dressing room.
Yeah, there's something rotten that runs through the entire club.
It's a culture shift. It's the culture that's wrong there, and they need to sign players who can change that.
Finally, we said goodbye to Cardiff City at the weekend, but Neil Warnock left us with a reaction gif to remember him with, squaring up to the camera like Liam Gallagher in his pomp. Has your opinion of Neil Warnock changed this season, JJ? We've said many times that you described Cardiff as a pub team and you weren't all that keen on him, but has he done anything this season to change what you think of him?
Nah.
Okay.
I love him. I love him so much.
I wasn't there, but the reason for the, you know, he was leaning up and forward into the camera.
Yeah.
I think that was him trying to be all sort of sarcastically get out of my face.
Yeah.
These cameras, it's something you realise, I've seen a few times, they get really, really close. I remember being at an England under-21 game recently, and Eddie Boothroyd had a camera really, really right up in his face. It's like uncomfortably close, like even from looking at it from afar. So I feel like Warnock was giving as good as he got, kind of thing.
Yeah, well within his rights there.
The inside story behind the gif.
You're listening to the Telegraph Audio Football Club, part of the Telegraph Podcasting Network. To find more of our podcasts, just go to telegraph.co.uk/podcasts.
Let's talk about the Football League. We have our two new Premier League teams for next year in Norwich City and Sheffield United, and four in the playoffs, Leeds, Villa, West Brom and Derby. Who do we think will win the playoffs, and who would you most like to see in the Premier League next year?
Oh, we want Leeds. Surely we all want Leeds in the Premier League with Bielsa and everything about them. No, you're turning your nose up as if you've smelt something.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't mind Leeds, but I would be reluctant to say, like, yes, we all want the Leeds as a nation. We want Leeds. I still think there's still quite a lot of people out there who aren't that keen on Leeds.
Tom likes to go against the grain.
I would like Leeds purely because I think they're ones who could go on to do something good or special. Because Bielsa is, well, he's one of the most influential managers of all time. Everyone talks about how he's influenced them, but. If you put something like Villa, West Brom or Derby, you know that all that's going to happen is they're going to end up finishing 12th and then they finish 15th and they're relegated after that. They never go anywhere else.
I really want Derby.
Do you? It's just such a middling existence. It must be so much more fun supporting them in the Championship. I know we talked about this a few times. But you can actually win games and enjoy it if you're in the lower league there. But if you have a manager of the class and history of Bielsa and you've got some money behind it and you can assemble a squad, they could do something quite decent if they went up.
One team looking forward to fun in the Championship next season will be Luton Town. Can we think of a bigger achievement than Mick Harford in caretaker charge this year in English football?
That's definitely up there. I mean, back-to-back promotions. Nathan Jones left, went to Stoke, and that was obviously a big... I mean, the players themselves have said that they thought that might be a turning point when he left. And then Mick Harford's come in, and in his own words, not done anything differently, and he's very much trying to say,
and the strange thing that he said from the start, I don't want this job, I'm not doing it beyond the end of the season, and he's seemingly not moving on that.
It's quite odd how he's so insistent that it's nothing to do with him when he's been the manager and the players are all saying that Mick's made a massive difference. But I think that's sort of the nature of who he is, really. Everyone around him, players he's a very overtly modest guy, I imagine, almost infuriatingly modest with this season. But back-to-back promotions, that's... And then they've got a new stadium on the way as well. It feels like the mood at Luton is very much on the up. And I think that's quite... They're proper club, Luton. It'd be good to see them doing well.
Lincoln winning League Two is really impressive for Danny Cowley, because they had that FA Cup run that kind of put them in the... Him and his brother are both the managers. Well, he's the manager, but his brother is assistant. Put them in the news. But they've... those boys are clearly really talented, especially Danny Cowley. So to win that with Lincoln, I think he's coming in and they've constantly improved. And he's dead young. He could well be. You think if a Premier League team needs needs someone who can, the way that Huddersfield signed the Dortmund reserve manager, you could look down to examples lower in the leagues, and you've got Cowley doing what he's done with Lincoln, and you have to think that's a kind of manager who's showing that they have potential to be something special. So in the same way you give young players a go, you should look at these kind of managers too.
Waving a sad goodbye from Notts County from league football, relegated out of the top four divisions for the first time in their 157-year history. Juventus even based their kit on Notts County's, meaning you personally must be taking this very hard.
I know, I cried all night. This is the first I've heard of it.
What about Leyton Orient? They're back in the Football League. They'll be joined by one of the new money sides, Fylde or Salford City. Reasons to believe that both of those will be okay next season in League Two. It tends to be all right, doesn't it, coming up from the National League into League Two. Those teams generally ride the crest of the wave.
Clearly the gap's not quite as big as the whole professional, non-professional, traditional divide is there. Leyton Orient, interesting. I think Leyton Orient have got the most highest proportion of journalist fans than any other club who aren't in the Premier League, I would think. I feel like every journalist in the country supports Leyton Orient and they're always tweeting about them. Luke Edwards being one of them, but there's more than just Luke. I feel like there's quite a few of them.
Let's turn our attention into Europe and the Champions League semi-finals. Liverpool 3-0 down at half-time in the tie. Do they have any hope at home to Barcelona? Surely not, with Sturridge and Origi potentially leading the line for them with Salah and Firmino out.
Yeah, I think you've basically just answered your own question.
Bad hosting.
Do you think Salah will not come back?
Who knows?
If it's a head injury, there's a protocol that's got to be a week or something between games if it is concussion to be suffered. But I can't actually say this because that would be dangerous to say that they'd want to try and hide it if you had to have it so they could play it.
It wouldn't be beyond the realms of what you would expect from football, would it?
Well, yeah, exactly. It's not really taken particularly seriously. It'd be good to explore the option of having temporary subs that come on if they have concussion injuries. I would imagine that they're going to have a lot of passionate, energetic Liverpool attacks here, but Barca are so classy. I can't see them. All they need is one counter-attack to get one goal, and that's them done.
Yeah. I could see Liverpool scoring three, but I can't see Liverpool keeping a clean sheet, I think, is the problem.
I think they'll get it close, but not over the line.
It's just the level of technique in Barcelona. It's like they don't even need to dominate the game. They don't need anything, really. They just need sort of about three chances, and they'll probably get you two goals.
Yeah, flawless technique under pressure. That's what those great players do. They don't hauk the ball forward chasing it. They just keep going the same way all the way through. First touch is always perfect.
Yeah, you never look at them and think, oh, they've squandered their chances, you know, like hugely. Although actually they missed two at the end, you know, Dembele had a good chance, but he's out for this match. But yeah.
What about Spurs? Mean they're going to Amsterdam to play Ajax on Wednesday. They've got to go for it this time, haven't they? They seem to try to sit back in the opening 25 minutes or so in the first leg, and that really didn't go well for them.
Yeah, weirdly enough for Ajax, it seems like they're better away from home than they are actually at home. They lost to Real Madrid at home and they drew to Juventus, but it's the way matches that they managed to do their best. The thing is, I feel a little bit sorry for Spurs because I just, you know, looking at that first match, you just thought, oh, what a difference it would have made had they had Son or had they had Kane or had they had even Lamella. You know, I Sam always like you always throw me off with your nodding and not nodding. But I don't know. I just feel like I do think that the presence of him will be huge for them in the sense of causing direct problems, and he's so fast and gets into the right positions that they need him to get into, to just introduce pace, to introduce that little bit of direct ability. It's strange with Ajax because I know they're good. They just won their first trophy over the weekend, obviously. And they are a sensational side. But I also think that they don't necessarily make the best decisions in the final third. That final pass isn't always great. They take way too many shots. They know how to control possession, but you should be able to know how to counter that game. And I don't know whether right now they have the squad that's fit enough to face them, but you really have to go gung-ho because what have they got to lose?
Yeah, Sonny will be back for this one. He'll make a big difference, won't he?
Spurs are going to do it.
No.
I think so too.
And they're going to win the whole thing. I have a weird feeling.
Spurs.
Do you?
Spurs looked at their best against Ajax in the first leg when they went long and they basically hit Llorente from deep and Sissoko came on and started charging down second balls, and they really sort of ruffled Ajax's feathers the most doing that. I wouldn't say Ajax were ever particularly ruffled. In the first half an hour, Spurs tried to play more like Spurs before Sissoko came on and they got thoroughly pumped. Ajax were just miles better at what they were doing than what Spurs were doing. And obviously, Son, being the kind of player he is, facilitates a more technical, measured build-up play. And or, you know, more technical approach rather than just lumping it to Llorente. And I just feel that having watched that game last week, that lumping it to Llorente was the bit when it, I suppose, at the most dangerous. So
I think totally the opposite. I thought exactly the opposite of what you said.
I agree.
When they were humping it long, I thought it was absolutely useless, and it's exactly how Ajax would win the game, because they have control of the game, because they are better with the ball. So by ceding possession, because they weren't really getting winning second balls and being able to push up, they were knocking it long, not being able to chase up. Ajax were winning it and they controlled the game. When Sissoko came on and they stopped hitting it, like punting it up the pitch, they were way better, and Ajax couldn't get hold of the game. And it was the tactical change that they said, the guy after, I think Van de Beek said afterwards, that it was the tactical change from Spurs that then switched the game to them, because they couldn't then play exactly the same way. They had complete control of it. And Sun will make a huge difference, because they've got actual pace when they can counter, so they can finally play the way they want. But I don't think they'll be quite as direct. I think they'll play just like Spurs do, just really solid, narrow, punting right through the middle without knocking it long. They'll just hit direct passes without launching it, if that makes sense.
I mean, when we were doing our studies on, as to how there's a potential that we can defeat Ajax, you know, for Juventus, it was always, they are very weak when it comes to crosses, and you need to just move in the area that it seems to really get them, because they don't actually, they're not a properly assembled defensive team other than De Ligt. There are a lot there who I don't know, you can't say are pure defenders, really. So looking at that, I think that's one way to get them. I think also set pieces, they need to really make the most of their set pieces, because I thought Ajax were terrible at defending them. I think there's a really good chance, if they study for this and prepare well, there's a really good chance with Son in the team.
I'm basing it purely on playing so much Football Manager, that when you tend to get a good little team together and you get towards the end of the season and you're going to finish Champions League spots, that's when you tend to win the Champions League.
Oh.
Yeah, that's why I've got a feeling with Spurs.
I just haven't been there for that first half an hour.
I'm 33.
For the penultimate time this season, let us hear a song for Europe from Mina Rizzuki. Mina, your beloved Juventus came close to home defeat in the Turin derby.
I know.
What's that rivalry like? Is there much hatred from Juve fans to Torino? Presumably Torino fans don't like Juve very much.
Actually, no, there isn't that much. I mean, obviously it's a derby and there is always going to be a bit of a hatred and some insults, but it's just, it's one of those cities where everyone just seems to be a little bit aristocratic, you know, and everyone is very well behaved. There isn't any madness in that city. And for very long, it's been as, I guess, the capital city of Italian football. And in many sense, if you count the number of points and the wins and on titles and whatever, it's actually the capital city when it comes to football in Europe, because Grande Torino was so huge. And obviously so have Juventus have been in the years after that. But there just doesn't seem to be that much hatred. It's always quite respectful. There was a wonderful banner because the Superga tragedy, which is obviously Grande Torino suffered. It was the 70th anniversary the day after. So there was a huge banner in dedication to all the victims that obviously passed away in that from the Juventus fans. There was one guy who was caught on camera saying some terrible things, but he was identified and Juventus have banned him from ever going to a match again. So, which goes to show that you can do that, which is something they need to implement when it comes to racism as well. But I just feel like it's kind of a little bit of a non-rivalry.
All a bit too civilised. What about in Spain, Mina? We talked about pronunciation for this before the show. I believe it's Getafe.
It is indeed Getafe.
how do you really pronounce it?
Getafe.
Getafe, lovely. They are fourth in La Liga, Champions League on for them at the moment. That would be an incredible achievement. How have they done it?
Oh, they have this coach who I cannot explain to you. Like, you know when we talk about these crazy coaches, his name is Jose Bordalas, and he's sort of like a journeyman, came up with the team. You know, he's insane, as in proper, like, sits there and whips his players. You know, he has this...
Like, not literally, surely.
Not literally, but there is actually a great story in which he puts a pencil in between the nose and the mouth of one of the defenders and gets him to cross his eyes so that he can look as crazy as possible to scare the opponent. I mean, he'll have any trick possible. Yeah, so it's like, you know, I want you to look as mad as possible. There's Sidlo some recounts some great stories because he's interviewed a lot of these players. But it's basically like he'll pester them around the pitch Look, Sam's doing it right now. Basically, he makes them keep that phase. So when they're playing a striker, the striker will continue to look at them and get distracted. You see, this is the amazingness of Bordalas. And
That's next level.
Chases them around their pitch. He annoys them. He yells abuse at them so that they're constantly focused on only their task. And he's got a wonderful fitness coach in Javier Vidal, who's a little bit like Ortega for Atletico Madrid, keeps all his players in line. And they just fight for him. They're motivated, they're interested. And what's really amazing about this is we talk about the kids of Ajax and we say this is the way forward. Their forward line is basically guys over 30 years old. They don't have a set defined, you know, they're aggressive, they're great in transitions. We can talk about the way that they play the game, but really what it is these guys are willing to die for their coach. And they have a fitness coach that's fantastic and always along with them as well. And I think when you think about that and you think of the likes of, they have Jaime Mata, who is a journeyman in the greatest sense, but who's just been amazing for them this season, and a team that's willing to do anything for each other, then that's all you need.
We've also got Mathieu Flamini.
Oh.
AKA biochemicals entrepreneur Mathieu Flamini.
The world's greatest midfielder.
And scientist.
As Dr. Flamini to you. Finally, Fulham brought on Harvey Elliott in the 88th minute of their game against Wolves this weekend. He was born on the 4th of April, 2003, which was 5 months before I started university. Utterly terrifying. My question to you all is, what in football makes you feel old? We asked our friends on Twitter. A fellow Tom with an H says, not Tom York, Lampard and Gerrard moving into management. I thought years of football manager would prepare me for player-to-manager transition, but they're still only just breaking into the first team, aren't they? Fair point. Sam, what in football makes you feel old?
Wait, hold on. Before all of this, did you say 5 years before you went to uni?
5 months before I went to university.
Right, okay.
Mine was a moment in a mix zone at Wembley at the start of last season when we were talking to Marcus Rashford after he'd scored for England, and we asked him, what was your first memory of England at a World Cup? And he said the Germany defeat in 2010.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, that's how young Marcus Rashford is. But I also think that's quite telling because he would have been about 12, 13 at that time. So what was he doing age 8 in 2006? I don't know.
He doesn't want it enough.
Doesn't want it enough, I know. But yeah, that felt particularly eye-opening.
What's yours, Mina?
My favourite World Cup was 1994. And obviously it was famous for Romario and Bebeto and that, you know, that celebration they had with the baby. The fact that that baby is now playing football is really upsetting to me. Because, I mean, now that he's what, like, how old is he now? He's 19, I think.
Sure.
No, he's well over 19 now. 25, yeah. I mean, now he's almost too old. For Ajax, he would have been thrown out by now. So that's when you start realizing to yourself that what's happened.
Yeah.
How old am I?
Yeah, we won't reveal that. JJ, what's your thing that makes you feel old?
Well, I always thought it would be when Michael Owen retired, but then it didn't really feel that old when he retired. What I did find really weird was when I went to interview Derek McInnes, who's the Aberdeen manager. I did it last year. I think I was 32 then. And I realised as I stepped in that I am older than all his outfield players. And that's weird because I don't feel like I'm that old. I still feel like I'm 21, 22. I guess most people are probably the same thing. But that's really odd. And it is a give me a little like jolt thinking that some people are just born to be these kind of natural footballers or leaders. Some people are just like that. That's the way they are conditioned or the way they naturally are. And it was not me. So I was never going to be able to captain Aberdeen.
Alas.
Tom,
alas.
What about you? Yeah.
Well, I think I've revealed this already on the podcast this year, but I always get a shirt, a QPR shirt each season, almost every season. I always get someone's name and number printed on the back because, like JJ, I'm a child. But this year I have Darnell Furlong's name on my back, and I realised he's the first QPR player whose father I've also had printed on my back at some point. His father's Paul Furlong, who was brilliant for QPR, and his son Darnell is now playing for us. So, circle of life.
Have you got these all in one place in the house?
Can you imagine if you have his kid in the future?
Oh, I've got to stop wearing football shirts within the next sort of 15 years, I think. Any older than, I don't know, what's the cutoff, 50?
I don't know. It is weird that you can just shout at footballers. No matter how old you get, you're still shouting at footballers as though they're your heroes. Like it's because that's. I remember when Paul Hayward wrote a thing about Lionel Messi. Mm. It was beautiful. And Messi gave him a... I think he signed something.
Yeah, he sent him a shirt.
Yeah, it was really a nice gesture. But even seeing like Paul Hayward, obviously like brilliant writer, and you have him talking about Messi as though it's a hero. I'd like that. It's quite special that it never goes away.
Yeah. It's quite different if you support QPR when Darnell Furlong is
here. I mean, I'd be glad to meet Darren Matthews.
That's your lot for this Monday show. We'll see you same time next week and also tomorrow. What a treat. You can contact me on Twitter if you'd like to. As ever, it's at Tom with an H Gibbs. The email address, afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. We will read out the best of what you send us. Don't forget to subscribe to get all of this week's shows. It's Telegraph Audio Football Club. Put those words into your computer, mobile device or tablet and take it from there. Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.